Chapter 6 New Confessions. Some teenagers were watching the Pope make a fast change in a fire station from his limousine to a more famous vehicle. As the white Pope-mobile sped away with its gold wheel rims flashing, they gasped, "Wow, just like Batman." All along the route, vendors sold t-shirts boasting, "I gotta a peek at the Pope." Initially, this was no problem, as only thin crowds turned out in Anglo neighborhoods or Koreatown, where fundamentalist hecklers were lined up to denounce the Polish Antichrist. But once the motorcade turned into the Westlake District, the largest Central American neighborhood in the United States, the scene was dramatically different. Suddenly the sidewalks were packed 10 to 15 deep with the faithful, who had been waiting hours for his arrival. Refugees from the killing fields of El Salvador or Guatemala, the so-called foot people of the Reagan era, many had borne witness as lay activists or members of the Comunidades de Base to the persecution of the Church of Liberation in Central America. Now from MacArthur Park to La Placida, in the tenement neighborhoods on the edge of the Los Angeles Garment District, they were gathered in cheering crowds as dense and fervid as those he had encountered in his triumphal procession through the Polish-American neighborhoods of Chicago. While most Anglo-Catholics stayed home in the suburbs watching the spectacle on television, the Central American and Mexican immigrants flocked to his side, while the bells tolled over the little church of Nuestra Señora la Reina de Los Ángeles de Porciúncula. A Catholic Restoration? The Pueblo of the Queen of the Angels is becoming a Catholic town again. A century ago, in the great boom of the late 1880s, Catholic Los Angeles was submerged by a wave of Protestant immigration from the Midwest. By the turn of the century, boosters were boasting that it was the ideal Protestant city, a bulwark against immigrant papism. Nearly 90% of its office holders were voluntarist Protestants. Its religious life was dominated by fire-breathing fundamentalists like Fighting Bob Schuller, a Ku Klux Klan supporter, and M.A. Semple McPherson. The so-called Fifth Great Revival that created modern Pentecostalism began in a downtown Los Angeles church, and each decade saw the emergence of new Southern California inflections of Protestantism, from the Angelus Temple to the Crystal Cathedral. Every census from 1920 to 1960 recorded that Los Angeles had the highest proportion of native-born white Protestants of the largest American cities. Now the pendulum is swinging back. In the early 1980s, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles surpassed Chicago to become the largest Catholic congregation in the USA, with an estimated 3.4 million parishioners growing at 1,000 per week. The Archdiocese accounts for at least 65% of communicant members of all religions in Los Angeles, Ventura, and Santa Barbara counties, according to 1980 data. That is to say, there are more than 20 Catholics for each adherent of the next largest religious group, in Los Angeles County, the Church of Latter-day Saints. Indeed, the Archdiocese is larger than the national memberships of either the Episcopalians or Presbyterians, or for that matter, any but four of America's national Protestant denominations. Moreover, the 8,762 square mile, three-county archdiocese, with its 300 parishes, 3,400 clerical, and 12,000 lay employees, has a massive and far-reaching institutional presence, comparable to one of California's largest corporations or city governments. It administers the second-largest school system in the state, after LA Unified, with 275 elementary schools and 71 high schools, enrolling 314,000 students. It also operates 10 cemeteries and 5 colleges, as well as 16 major hospitals treating more than 1 million patients per year. In addition, the Archdiocese is one of the state's largest landowners. Besides churches, rectories, and parking lots, it controls through one of its 7 chartered corporations, Roman Catholic Archbishop Incorporated, more than 900 parcels of local real estate worth several billion dollars. More significant than sheer size, however, is the multifaceted strategic position of the Archdiocese. The suburban church in Southern California has long been one of the Vatican's most difficult frontiers in the struggle between traditional moral dogma and modern individualism. Now, the Los Angeles Archdiocese is also a cutting edge in geopolitical controversies, over the Latin Americanization of world and American Catholicism. The renaissance of Catholicism in Southern California is a byproduct of the irresistible demographics of Latino immigration and family size, what the Quebecois call the revenge of the cradle. Over the last generation, the archdiocese has become nearly two-thirds Mexican and Central American in ethnic origin, with more than 1 million Latino Catholics added during the 1980s alone. Yet the archdiocese also retains hundreds of thousands of affluent Anglos. This dramatic mingling of the first and third worlds makes it a laboratory for the church's cautious experiments in ethnic accommodation and power sharing. At the same time, it is also the major battlefield north of the Rio Bravo, in an increasingly high-stake competition between Catholicism and aggressive Spanish-language evangelicalism. In addition, the Archdiocese is a major force shaping the post-Anglo polyethnic Los Angeles of the year 2000. Three aspects of its role are particularly important. First, there is the aggressive leadership of Archbishop Mahoney. Only 53 years old, he is likely to remain in St. Viviana's Cathedral until his retirement in the year 2011. Although occasionally seen demonstrating against repression in Central America, his public persona is mainly identified with a moral backlash against gender and sexual equality. In blessing Operation Rescue while denouncing safe sex, the ambitious archbishop has become a rising star of the National Right to Life movement, as well as a favorite of Vatican hardliners. And to the dismay of most of his early progressive supporters, the former champion of the Farm Workers Union and first chairman of California's Agricultural Labor Relations Board has also become an increasingly strident opponent of organized labor, turning a small-scale dispute over the unionization of Catholic gravediggers into a full-fledged confrontation with a statewide labor movement. Both his critics and admirers within the church now compare him to the late Cardinal McIntyre, whose autocratic regime suffocated the archdiocese during the Cold War years and led to the exodus of many liberal Catholics. Secondly, a Catholic power structure combining Mahoney's spiritual authority with the economic clout of leading laymen plays an important, if discreet, role in city politics and land use decision-making. The Eminence Grise of Richard Reardon, investment banker, land developer, city commissioner, lawyer for the archdiocese, and intimate of Mahoney, raises a number of especially intriguing questions about the traffic in influence between the hierarchy and the city's invisible government of developers and bankers. Thirdly, as the dominant organizer of community life in the city's barrios, the church unavoidably assumes a central role in the Latinos' search for power. It will be a major arbiter of social and political realignments between old and new status quos. Yet the church itself is a contested terrain between different strategies of empowerment. On the one hand, Mahoney's 1987 Latino Aid Plan, together with single-issue campaigns organized by episcopally approved community groups, offer gradualist and legalistic approaches to Latino advancement in church and society. On the other hand, Father Luis Solares and his fellow Claretian and Jesuit priests downtown represent liberation theology's preferential option for the poor, emphasizing direct action in favor of the oppressed, even when this defies secular law. Although the debate between Mahoney and Olivares is rooted in local circumstances, many Catholics believe that it reflects global stakes, what the late Penny Lernoux called the struggle for the soul of the contemporary church between the liberationists and the restorationists. Not surprisingly, a portrait of Zapata and a quotation from Sandino hang over Olivares's modest desk, while Pope John Paul II smiles over the archbishop's elegant writing table. It is the interplay of these local and international dimensions, the simultaneous salience of neighborhood organizing and church geopolitics, that makes the archdiocese perhaps the most fascinating institution in Southern California. A mission on the rim of the world. As the local branch of the oldest surviving complex organization in the world, the contemporary archdiocese needs to be first situated in its own unique historical context. The Catholic legacy of Los Angeles is preserved in the archives at Mission San Fernando del Rey, just outside the small city of the same name, a few blocks from where Richie Valens grew up. The archive is a building of unexpected opulence, containing not only musty baptismal ledgers and parish accounts, but also part of the great Doheny Library and priceless ecclesiastical treasures, including heirlooms of the Mexican church brought out of the country during the Cristero Revolt of the 1920s by its fleeing bishops. Saturated in a surprisingly Baroque ambiance, the archives have for many decades supported the labors of Monsignor Francis Weber, keeper of the keys to the archdiocese history. Unfortunately, the Monsignor's own efforts, which take up an entire shelf, consist mainly of voluminous, often repetitious anecdotes. A protege and defender of the late Cardinal McIntyre, and openly skeptical of the Latino orientation of the present archbishop, the Monsignor has devoted much of his life to sketching idealized vignettes of the early California church. Although the forced labor system of the original Franciscan missions was tantamount to slavery, as California Indian leaders have recently reminded the church, Monsignor Weber, a leading crusader for the canonization of Father Serra, defends a vision of gentle padres and their happy neophytes. It is an image drawn not so much from his archives as from the pages of Helen Hunt Jackson's famous 1880s novel, Ramona, a romance that generations of tourists and white Angelenos have confused with real history. It is no accident that the church still relies upon the mission myth as a buffer between itself and its past. Despite its precedence in the order of Southern California's colonization, indeed, the small secular pueblo of Los Angeles was founded by Bourbon bureaucrats to counter the growing danger of a Franciscan theocracy, the church has never become fully indigenous. To this day, it retains a sense of being a missionary outpost on the rim of the Western world, with a hierarchy drawn from outside its majority communities. In the 18th and 19th centuries, the California church, divided between North and South in 1853, was dominated by a Catalan dynasty, Serra, Majorca, Alemany, Amat, and Mora. In the 20th century, from the appointment of Bishop Thomas Canati in 1903 to the current regime of Archbishop Mahoney, the modern archdiocese has been led by Irishmen or their American descendants. No one of Mexican or Latin American origin has ever risen higher than the current auxiliary bishops, Juan Arzube, appointed 1971, and Armando X. Ochoa, 1986. Given their historic lack of power in the archdiocese, Latino parishioners have long been accustomed to variable doses of neglect, paternalism, and accommodation. Archbishop John Cantwell, 1917 through 47, a Limerick man like many of his priests, is officially celebrated for pioneering the modern mission to the Spanish-speaking. During the 1920s and early 1930s, he provided refuge for the exiled Mexican episcopate, at one point 36 bishops and archbishops, and established 50 new parishes for Mexican immigrants. He inaugurated the annual Corpus Christi procession on the east side, from Our Lady of Guadalupe to La Soledad, that for many years rivaled Cinco de Mayo in community importance. He was the first North American churchman to make the pilgrimage to the shrine of the Virgin of Guadalupe. Yet his attitude to his half-million Mexican parishioners was characterized by unwavering condescension, the simple people of God, and entrenched hostility to the community's progressive and nationalist currents. In the 1920s, the archdiocese became a major support base for the Cristero Revolt, a church-instigated guerrilla movement of Catholic peasants in the central plateaus of Mexico. In a civil war without mercy on either side, Cristeros assassinated secular schoolteachers and blew up passenger trains, while troops of the Antichrist, President Plutarco Calles, executed priests and their peasant parishioners. The defeat of the Cristeros in 1928 only hardened Cantwell's antipathy to the revolutionary nationalist Mexican state. Following another wave of clerical expulsions from Sonora in 1934, he organized the largest demonstration in Los Angeles history, a giant procession of 40,000 people, many of them Cristero refugees, chanting Viva Cristo Rey and marching behind banners that denounced the atheistic regimes in Mexico City and Moscow. Some contemporary critics smelled oil as well as incense in Cantwell's lobbying for U.S. intervention on behalf of Mexican Catholics. Washington did move military forces to the border. The Archdiocese's most generous endower, the builder of St. John's Seminary, was oil millionaire Edward Doheny, a papal count and the richest Catholic in Los Angeles. He is probably best remembered in American history for the $100,000 bribe that put ex-Secretary of the Interior Fall in jail during the Teapot Dome scandal in 1921. But Doheny was also the original wildcatter of the Tampico oil fields, and together with his partner Harry Sinclair, the biggest individual foreign investor in Mexico. He had an obvious personal stake in a Cristero victory, or a Marine landing. Cantwell's politics were nothing if not consistent. Local Catholic Action rallies through the 1930s also applauded Franco and Mussolini, while the Legion of Decency denounced celluloid immorality in Hollywood. The archdiocesan newspaper Tidings poured vitriol on the New Deal and red-baited local political progressives. As a result, Catholic Los Angeles, already at the losing end of its Kulturkampf with hegemonic local Protestantism, isolated itself as well from New Dealers, intellectuals, the Jewish community, and CIO trade unionists. True Confessions of Cardinal McIntyre. Hopes that Cantwell's backward-looking 30-year reign would be followed by a liberal succession were dashed in 1948, when Pope Pius XII appointed Francis McIntyre to Los Angeles. Chancellor to the American Pope, New York's all-powerful Cardinal Spellman, McIntyre has been described by Spellman's biographer as a mean-spirited, vindictive man who employed Gestapo tactics against pro-labor priests in the New York Archdiocese. The train that carried McIntyre to the West Coast was cynically called the Freedom Train by New York priests who were glad to be rid of him. Consecrated as Western America's first cardinal in 1953, McIntyre used his rising power to witch hunt suspected liberals in the hierarchy. Thus, when Bishop James Shannon of Minneapolis dared to criticize McCarthyism, McIntyre attacked him as an incipient heretic and hounded him into resignation. He also thoroughly Spellmanized Los Angeles, silencing moderate voices and mobilizing the archdiocese against every liberal cause in Southern California. His paper, Tidings, became particularly notorious as a pulpit of McCarthyism, with red-baiting fulminations drawn from the Hearst Press and the fringes of the John Birch Society. As a holy cold warrior, however, McIntyre was only following in the well-trodden footsteps of Spellman and others. His individual genius was rather as an ecclesiastical entrepreneur who broke all records for school and church construction. Before the priesthood, he'd worked on Wall Street, and his business acumen, including his ruthlessness in labor relations, had been decisive in his meteoric rise in the New York Chancery. In Los Angeles, at the height of the post-war suburban boom, when the incoming mostly Anglo-Catholic population was 1,000 per week, McIntyre transformed his see into a huge development company, setting up 7 major archdiocesan corporations and a dependent network of approved contractors and vendors. He also successfully battled public education leaders to win tax exemption for his burgeoning parochial school system. It was this McIntyre, the spiritually hollow, he was dubbed his emptiness by his own priests, but financially shrewd and politically well-connected autocrat, whom John Gregory Dunn made the eminence grise of his novel about post-war Los Angeles Catholics, True Confessions. McIntyre's unbending authoritarianism went virtually unchallenged during the conformist 1950s. However, with the convocation of the Second Vatican Council in 1962 and John XXIII's program of modernization, aggiornamento, or bringing up to date, McIntyre, a diehard opponent of the reform process, found himself at the head of a gradually shrinking minority of conservative American bishops. Younger clergy under the dual spell of Vatican II and the social protests of the 1960s began to question McIntyre's autocracy and to confront his reactionary political positions. A particular source of contention was McIntyre's defense of L.A. Police Chief William Parker, a hated and feared figure in Black Los Angeles, but the apple of the cardinal's eye. Parker was the most powerful Catholic in local government, and incarnated the authoritarian virtues admired by McIntyre, When police racism was implicated in the Watts Rebellion of 1965, the Cardinal rallied to Parker, denouncing the rioters as inhuman, almost bestial. Tidings political columnist George Kramer added that reports of police abuse were only an old communist canard. This infuriated a young priest in a predominantly black parish, Father William DeBay, who lashed out at McIntyre for his lifelong silence on racial injustice and called upon the Pope to remove him. Although DeBay was immediately suspended, his views were echoed by an ad hoc group called Catholics United for Racial Equality, CURE. These were only opening skirmishes. In 1968, McIntyre split the archdiocese apart in a heavy-handed attempt to crush clerical liberalism. The highly esteemed teaching order of the Immaculate Heart of Mary had evolved in the middle 60s toward greater engagement in social issues, including the civil rights and anti-war movements. Although McIntyre initially focused his public condemnations against the order's experiments with secular dress styles and new teaching methods, there was never any doubt that the real issue was their social activism. Cheered on by the political right, the cardinal expelled the order from the archdiocesan schools. More than 25,000 outraged parishioners, in turn, signed a petition to the Pope requesting his intervention to protect the order. Ultimately, 300 Immaculate Heart nuns, the majority of the order, chose to become a lay community rather than accede to McIntyre's orders. The purge of Immaculate Heart, as well as the archdiocese's entrenched opposition to Vatican II's liturgical and structural reforms, destroyed any common ground for compromise between McIntyre and progressive Catholics. As he became more isolated, the cardinal, like the embattled dictator of a banana republic, resorted to increasingly paranoid surveillance and repression. Nolan Davis has described the tragic consequences. Scores of nuns and priests began to leave the religious life entirely, and an underground church began to proliferate. Contributions to the established church plummeted by 40%. McIntyre, who maintained an elaborate and highly effective spy network, fought back, sending priests and monsignors and other faithful to him in disguise into the homes of underground Catholics, armed with hidden tape recorders. Whenever a priest was caught conducting one of the liberalized masses, he was reported to the cardinal. Scores of dissident priests and nuns were removed from their parishes, some exiled to McIntyre's favorite Siberia, Orange County. A visiting Italian Jesuit wrote to Rome that priests in Los Angeles worked in an atmosphere of sheer terror. Eventually, a wing of the dissent overlapped with the Chicano power movement sweeping across California. As their turn came to protest the Chancery's paternalism and neglect, as well as its continuing support for the war in Vietnam, militant East Side Catholics, led by writer-lawyer Oscar Acosta, the celebrated Brown Buffalo, decided to confront McIntyre with nonviolent civil disobedience. On Christmas Eve 1969, 100 members of Católicos por la Raza marched from Lafayette Park to the Midnight Mass at St. Basil's, McIntyre's $4 million showcase residence church on a ritzy stretch of Wilshire Boulevard. They were demanding an equal voice for Chicanos in the archdiocese, as well as full public disclosure of the Chancery's financial Wheeler dealings. As the marchers commenced a prayer vigil on the steps, they were attacked by off-duty sheriffs, acting as McIntyre's ushers. In the general melee that followed, a police tactical alert was declared and the riot squad was called in. While the scene in the church vestibule was of fist-swinging, pushing, screaming, and kicking, the archbishop led the rest of the well-heeled congregation in singing O Come All Ye Faithful in order to drown out the noise of protest. In spite of mass arrests and police beatings, the protesters reappeared in greater numbers on Christmas Day with an angry picket line. For his part, McIntyre compared the demonstrators to the rabble at Christ's crucifixion, and in an ultimate gesture of overweening paternalism, arranged a special mass of loyal Chicanos at the old church in the plaza to pray for forgiveness for the demonstrators. But St. Basil's was strictly a Pyrrhic victory for the cardinal. The archdiocese was confused and demoralized from the succession of public quarrels and purges of oppositionists. McIntyre himself was in his mid-80s and was no longer able to maintain his traditional fierce regimen. Above all, the Vatican was weary of his intransigence and alarmed by the publicity given to the internecine struggles. Barely a month after the Battle of St. Basil's, McIntyre bowed to pressure from Pope Paul VI and announced his retirement. His successor was Bishop Timothy Manning of Fresno. The Quiet Man. A protege of Archbishop Cantwell, the wiry, soft-brogued Manning from Ballingeary, County Cork, had risen rapidly, becoming at 36 the youngest bishop in the USA in 1946. For the next quarter century, however, he languished under McIntyre's shadow, first as auxiliary and then as chancellor, until he received his own San Joaquin Valley diocese in 1967. His personality, usually described as moderate or non-confrontational, was a dramatic contrast to the imperious, intolerant McIntyre. Moreover, unlike his predecessor, Manning had genuine sympathy for dissidents, derived from his childhood experiences of black and tan brutality during Ireland's War of Independence. One of his first acts as archbishop was to support the right of young Catholics to become conscientious objectors against the war in Vietnam, something that had been anathema to McIntyre. Manning came to power with a program of reforms aimed to undo the damage of McIntyre's last years and to win back the confidence of inner-city parishes and clergy. In direct repudiation of McIntyre's celebrity lifestyle, he moved his residence out of the Wilshire Boulevard area and back to St. Viviana's Cathedral on Skid Row. He encouraged the archdiocese to catch up with Vatican II reforms by establishing a consultative priests' senate and made a gesture toward ecumenicism, which McIntyre had derided, by becoming active in the Interreligious Council of Southern California, headed by Rabbi Alfred Wolfe. Most importantly, he began to redress the benign neglect of South Central and East Side parishes. He levied a light tax on suburban parishes to pay for long overdue improvements and repairs on inner-city churches and schools. Modifying McIntyre's previous insistence on compulsory Americanization, he introduced bilingual classes into parochial schools on the East Side, popularized the liturgy with Spanish-language masses, and integrated the coverage of tidings with new attention to black and Latino affairs. On the 9th of February 1971, he nominated Ecuador-born Juan Arzurbe as Los Angeles's first auxiliary bishop of Latino origin. Yet, ancien régimes are not so easily, or peacefully, transformed. Despite the Los Angeles Times' claim in early 1972 that Manning had already revitalized the church in Southern California, becoming renowned as one of the most socially progressive Catholic officials in America, the reality was somewhat different. Unlike the Scrooge-like McIntyre who signed every check, Manning, elevated to cardinal in 1973, had no aptitude for administration or finance. Bureaucratic authority in the archdiocese, as a result, devolved onto his conservative vicar general, Monsignor Benjamin Hawks, who exercised sweeping power as a kind of shadow cardinal. Most importantly, despite his tax on the suburbs and the appointment of a Latino auxiliary, Manning was unable to stop the hemorrhage of inner-city Catholics, both black and Latino, that had begun during the 1960s. The real issue remained empowerment versus paternalism. Eastside Catholics wanted something more substantial than mariachi masses. But Manning's own romanticized view of Irish-Mexican relations made it difficult for him to appreciate the urgency of Latino demands within the church. In a famous speech at McIntyre's installation in 1948, he had evoked instead a Celto-Californian religious synthesis, a blend of green and brown, rain and sunshine, a perfect mating of two traditions of faith. He clung to this personal version of the mission myth for the next 40 years. Since the fusion of cultures was perfect, he saw no incongruity in the continuation of Celtic leadership over an archdiocese that, in the last year of his reign, was nearly 70% Latino. Despite the tactical appointment of Arzurbe, he inveighed vehemently against the theory that you have to have ethnic leaders, and controversially appointed a white as episcopal vicar to Los Angeles's black community. Even faced with dramatic evidence of the success of Protestant evangelicalism on the East Side, he confidently reassured an interviewer that all Latinos are really Catholic. Yet on unguarded occasions, the Cardinal would admit that he still thought of Los Angeles as a foreign mission, the rim of the Western world. At once indecisive and paternalistic, Manning oversaw an interregnum, or low-key hiatus, in the words of his Times obituary, not a real transition. Perhaps his greatest mistake was in failing to create consultative structures for his rapidly growing Latino parishes. One of the key Vatican II reforms most opposed by McIntyre had been the establishment of parish councils to implement the new goal of shared responsibility. After 5 years of Manning's reforms, Los Angeles still lagged in last place amongst the large archdioceses, with councils in only 12% of local parishes, as contrasted to 72% nationally. And amongst the minority of parishes with councils, there was widespread criticism of their unrepresentative and sycophantic character. The laggard pace of Latino advancement sowed anger within the archdiocese and throughout the Southwest. In 1970, Latino priests formed Padres, translated from Spanish as United Priests for Religious, Educational, and Social Causes, to lobby for greater attention to Latino issues. When Bishop Leo Mar of San Diego announced in 1978 the formation of a new predominantly Chicano diocese, encompassing Riverside and San Bernardino counties, expectations were raised that one of three Southern California Latino auxiliaries, Juan Arzurbe or Manuel Moreno from Los Angeles, or Gil Chavez from San Diego, acting vicar for San Bernardino, would be selected. Gossip heavily favored Arzurbe, the most senior of the Latino auxiliaries, whom Manning had elevated on the same day in 1971 as Bishop William Johnson, since 1976 the head of the spin-off diocese of Orange County. Rome's decision, in consultation with Cardinal Manning, to award the new diocese instead to Philip Strahling, an Anglo who spoke only halting Spanish, sparked an explosion. An encuentro of Padres and Las Hermanas, sisters, near Las Cruces, New Mexico, 150 Latino clergy, including Archbishop Robert Sanchez of Santa Fe and Bishop Patricio Flores of El Paso, sent a letter to the Vatican's apostolic delegate in Washington, Archbishop Jean Chadeau, protesting the Strahling appointment as an insult to the Hispanic community of California and the country. In the Inland Empire, a series of mass demonstrations, organized by Armando Navarro of the Congress for United Communities, expressed anguish, indignation, and outrage, a sentiment echoed by such distinguished rally speakers as Cesar Chavez, State Senator Ruben Ayala, and Bishop Chavez. At a conclave of the California hierarchy in Redlands in November, 15 Latino lay representatives met with Cardinal Manning and several bishops. They demanded Latino bishops for majority Latino dioceses, with candidates drawn from the more progressive religious orders, as well as the ordinary clergy, and lay participation in the nomination process. Maria Huyen, one of the Latino delegates from St. Edward's Parish in Corona, later described the prelate's response as evasive, defensive, resistant, vague, and trite. The ugly head of racism has won out. Meanwhile, throughout the parochial school system, Latino and Black parents were complaining about the chancery's refusal to act against racist or physically abusive administrators and teachers. In 1982, 3 years before Manning's retirement, the long-festering Catholic school crisis exploded in Pico Rivera. 77 parents, calling themselves Parents for Christian Justice, filed a $3 million suit against the principal of St. Hilary's Elementary, Sister Urban Maureen Molitar, and the Archdiocese, alleging systematic discrimination and physical emotional abuse against Mexican students. They claimed that their children had been punched, had had their mouths taped shut for entire days, had been shoved headfirst into walls, had been hoisted into the air by their cheeks, and had been called liars, animals, stupid, unteachable, and so on. Petitions to higher authorities, including Cardinal Manning himself, had been ignored, and as a result, more than an eighth of the student body had been withdrawn by their parents. Alienated Latino Catholics did not typically join protest groups like Católicos por la Raza or sue the archdiocese. Instead, they voted quietly with their feet. Surveys conducted by the Hispanic Secretariat for the U.S. Catholic Conference revealed a mass exodus of Latinos in the 1970s, Perhaps a fifth of Spanish surname Catholics in Los Angeles converted to other religions during the decade. Nationally, a tenth of Latino Catholics were lost in the 1970s and 1980s, something that Catholic sociologist Andrew Greeley has characterized as an ecclesiastical failure of unprecedented proportions. The winners were evangelical sects, particularly the Assemblies of God and the Billy Graham-style Latinos para Cristo, who offered unhappy Spanish-speaking Catholics a more individuated and emotionally intense religious experience, and whose ministers, in contrast to most Catholic parishes, were themselves Latinos. Although, as we shall see, the Church now claims to be addressing the roots of Latino disaffection, the conversion rate of the evangelicals amongst newly arrived Spanish-speaking immigrants remains very high, 15 to 25%, and some Catholic bishops have warned that the Church could lose up to half of its Latino members over the next generation. The Mahoney Enigma. One of the prelates who met with the protesters in Redlands in 1978 was the young auxiliary bishop of Fresno, Roger Mahoney. Growing up in the still semi-rural San Fernando Valley of the 1940s and 1950s, Mahoney practiced Spanish with his father's poultry plant workers. Later, armed with a degree in social work from Catholic University in Washington, D.C., he became secretary to the U.S. Catholic Bishops Ad Hoc Committee on Farm Labor, serving as their eyes and ears during the heroic early days of the United Farm Workers Crusade in the San Joaquin Valley. His bilingualism and expertise on social conditions in the valley, at a time when California elites, political and religious, were feeling the pressure of Latino demands, catapulted him into the ecclesiastical fast track. Closely associated with Archbishop Manning from the late 1960s, he became successively the Director of Charities and Social Work in Fresno, Auxiliary Bishop, 1975, first Chair of the State's Agricultural Labor Relations Board, 1975, and then Bishop of Stockton, 1980. Having risen to having his own see at age 42, it was rumored that Mahoney could even have a shot at an urban diocese like San Diego or Sacramento before he was 50. When, in 1985, public rumors of Manning's retirement became rife, there was widespread speculation that Rome would finally address Latino petitions and appoint either Archbishop Sanchez of Santa Fe or Archbishop Flores of San Antonio as the cardinal successor. Since Manning's accession 15 years earlier, the archdiocese, despite the separation of Orange County, had doubled in size from 1.5 million to 3 million, with the bulk of the increase coming from Spanish-speaking immigrants. A dramatic realignment of church leadership to reflect Latino demographics seemed long overdue. When instead Manning retired in early 1986, and the Vatican announced the appointment of Mahoney as the youngest archbishop in North America, at age 49, Latino disappointment, which might otherwise have erupted in another exodus or wave of protest, was partially ameliorated by the new prelate's reputation. Although he was another Celt in the same old ethno-dynastic succession, Mahoney was also a fluent Spanish speaker, whose entire career had involved ministering to campesinos and the Latino working classes. Having marched with Cesar Chavez, he was also reputed to be a strong defender of immigrant rights, who had repeatedly stood up to the INS. A leader in the Bishop's Committee for the Spanish-speaking, he was felt to have a sophisticated and sympathetic overview of the situation of Latino Catholics. Moreover, in dramatic contrast to the McIntyre tradition, Mahoney was an outspoken proponent of nuclear disarmament who played a leading role in the dissemination of the American bishop's famous 1983 pastoral letter on peace. Unsurprisingly, some observers, within the church as well as without, thought they saw in Mahoney, as others had in Cardinal Wojtyla a decade before, the arrival of an innovative spirit, liberal if not radical, on the big social questions. In fact, Mahoney arrived not only as a former peacenik, but equally as an outspoken doctrinal conservative and papal monarchist. Avowing that church dogma was simply not negotiable, he had clamped a tight lid on teaching and discussion within his Stockton diocese. Outside religious speakers of any kind were forbidden except with his express approval. Soon after becoming Archbishop of Los Angeles, he parroted the calumnies against academic freedom at American Catholic universities being spread by Cardinal Ratzinger, the head of the Vatican's Latter-day Inquisition, singling out a distinguished moral theologian who had challenged Vatican strictures on artificial birth control, Mahoney claimed that Father Charles Curran of the Catholic University had been over-influenced by the reigning ethos of academic freedom. It therefore becomes more necessary than ever for the Church to have firm authority structures. On another occasion, Penny Lernoux reported that Mahoney advised American Catholics that they could dissent if they kept the matter to themselves or told only a few close friends. Public dissent by people who wanted to modify the Church's teaching was prohibited. Evidence suggests that Mahoney's appointment was a complex move in a Vatican strategy to reshape the American hierarchy. Thomas Rees, a Jesuit sociologist studying the American episcopate, has described how since 1980, with the purge of apostolic delegate Jadot, blamed for too many liberal nominations, the Vatican has reclaimed control of the selection process. The body of the American hierarchy is no longer consulted as a matter of course. Many church observers felt that Mahoney was expressly selected to bolster a conservative bloc of recent appointments that includes Cardinals Law of Boston and O'Connor of New York, both 1984, as well as Cardinal Bevilacqua of Philadelphia, 1987. According to Rees, Mahoney was sponsored by Archbishop Justin Regali, originally from Los Angeles, who, as president of the Vatican's diplomatic school and speechwriter for the Pope, has had a powerful behind-the-scenes influence on appointments to the American hierarchy. Predictably, the Roman support that elevated Mahoney to St. Bibiana's Cathedral in Los Angeles has also ensured his nomination to prestigious pontifical bodies, including the Synod of Bishops and the Vatican Councils on Peace and Migrants. On the other hand, the American bishops, identifying with Mahoney and the Vatican bureaucracy, and the theological crackdown, have twice rebuffed his aspirations for NCCB office, in 1986 and 1989. It would be nonetheless misleading to suggest that Mahoney is a mere lackey of the Vatican or a McIntyre Redux, although their similar penchants for authoritarian management are often compared these days. Ideological cross-currents in the contemporary church are far more complex than they were in the 1950s. Wojtyla's rabid anti-communism, for instance, goes hand in hand with denunciations of free enterprise that would have scandalized McIntyre or Spellman as Marxist. And unlike several Roman clones whom Regali and Ratzinger parachuted into the ranks of the American bishops during the 1980s, Mahoney, though a papal loyalist, is a completely homegrown product of the U.S. hierarchy. If he has been resented at times for supporting Roman hardliners in their attacks on American doctrinal liberals, he has also been admired for his untiring energy on pastoral task forces, including peace, international affairs, of which he was elected chair, and the right to life. Yet in summing up the qualities visible at the time of his appointment in 1985, it would be too easy to say that Mahoney was a social liberal and doctrinal conservative, a formula commonly used to characterize Catholic politics these days. On a scale of liberalism where many American bishops now stand to the left of the Democratic Party on crucial issues of peace and economic justice, Mahoney leaned to the right, closer to old gardists like Cardinal Law of Boston than to Vatican II progressives like Archbishop Weakland of Milwaukee. Even his very liberal stances on labor and immigration have been nuanced by his emphasis on respect for authority and moderation of protest. Although he frequently criticized immigration officials, he insisted on compliance with the law and opposed the strategy of sanctuary. A longtime supporter of the farm workers, he became increasingly critical of their tactics after his appointment to the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, ALRB, by Jerry Brown. And, despite the endorsement of the Bishop's Committee on the Spanish-Speaking, he opposed the 1975 grape and lettuce boycott. A shrewd and sophisticated politician, moving acrobatically between Vatican, NCCB, and secular power structures, Mahoney in 1985, like Wojtyla in 1978, was an enigma awaiting better definition. The Latino Aid Plan. In a single broad stroke, a year after moving into St. Bibiana's Cathedral, Archbishop Mahoney attempted to redress the accumulated grievances of his East Side parishes. His Latino Aid Plan, announced in May 1986, was heralded as a dramatic reorientation from the archdiocese's traditional Anglo power centers towards its new Latino majority. combining an ambitious program of evangelization with social activism, while subtly preserving the underlying tradition of paternalism, the aid plan registered not only a new dynamism in the chancery after the drift of the Manning years, but also a potential quantum leap in the church's role in the political and social life of Los Angeles's largest ethnic sector. Yet it was a leap made only after cautious trial-and-error experimentation in Eastside parishes during the last half of the Manning episcopate. This prelude to Mahoney's plan requires a brief accounting. Under the careful supervision of Auxiliary Bishop Arzurbe, Eastside parishes had been allowed to introduce more culturally accessible rituals and catechisms. Small, intense evangelical study groups promoting a conversion experience, Cursillos de Cristiandad, had been imported from Spain, where they had animated the fascist Catholic Action Movement, and spread rapidly through the Southwest. The Cursillos, as well as the tremendously popular marriage encounter retreats, offered Latino Catholics, in the word of a Chicano Jesuit, unabashedly effective religious community as a counterbalance to a more somber, even cold kind of Catholicism of Northern origins that has dominated North American Catholicism. The popularity of the Cursillos, in turn, paved the way for official acceptance of the Bible-thumping, tent-shaking revivalism of the Charismatic Renewal Movement in the 1970s. Nervously sanctioned by Manning and Arzurbe, the new movement was opposed to many old-line priests who considered its practices shockingly un-Catholic. Charismatism was a deliberate and far-reaching adaptation of Catholic liturgy to Pentecostal emphasis on scripture, personal devotion, and ecstatic celebration. Although the charismatic movement of the 1970s and early 1980s swept through Anglo as well as Latino parishes, its spiritual epicenter was East Los Angeles, and the estimated 60,000 Latino charismatics participating in 140 Spanish-speaking prayer communities. An ex-Assembly of God minister, Marilyn Kramer, who converted to Catholicism in 1972, founded Charisma in Missions, an East LA-based group fighting on the religious front line against the Spanish-language evangelicals. A Times reporter covering one of the group's giant monthly gatherings at the old Olympic Auditorium was struck most by the similarity to traditional fundamentalism. Except for the manner in which communion is administered, an Eastside charismatic revival could easily be mistaken for a Pentecostal service. Participants clap their hands and sway while in song. They cry while praying with uplifted hands. They shout out hallelujahs during the sermon, and occasionally they speak in the tongues of the Holy Spirit. The success of charismatism, which roused thousands of dormant or borderline Latino Catholics, encouraged the chancery to allow Eastside parishes to organize around community issues as well. Like many other big city archdioceses, Los Angeles already had some experience with the Industrial Areas Foundation, IAF, model of parish community self-help. The IAF is the national outgrowth of organizer Saul Alinsky's famous Chicago neighborhood movements, Back of the Yards, the Woodlawn Organization. Built in alliance with Cardinal Stritch during the 1940s and 1950s, often using young priests as community organizers. The Community Services Organization, an earlier Alinskyite formation, had played a significant role in East Los Angeles since the 1950s, training organizers, notably Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, fighting discrimination and registering voters. A new layer of IAF-style community organizations emerged in the 1970s after the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, reacting to Nixon's rollback of the War on Poverty, decided to subsidize self-help movements of the urban and rural poor. As the bishops rescued or restarted local anti-poverty organizations across the country, they also built an important new political infrastructure for the church in the inner cities. Perhaps the most impressive of these new groups was San Antonio's Communities Organized for Public Service, COPS. Unlike most previous Alinskyite groups, it was built monolithically on the existing parish structure with little pretense of autonomy from the Catholic Church. With support from the Bishop's Campaign for Human Development and the IAF, COPS conducted highly successful voter registration drives, challenged the local Chamber of Commerce's promotion of the city as a sweatshop paradise, and fought to channel federal block grant money directly to neighborhoods. Sent by Manning to observe COPS firsthand, Arzurbe returned an enthusiast. Here, he claimed, was a perfect strategy for reintegrating alienated Eastside parishes while strengthening Catholic social values and Chicano political clout at the same time. With initial participation from 20 parishes, especially Father Luis Olivares's La Soledad, and under the direction of an IAF veteran from Chicago, Peter Martinez, the fledgling United Neighborhood Organization, UNO, began evening and weekend training workshops for its initial cadre of 150 grassroots leaders. Like similar groups across the country, influenced by Linsky's ideas, UNO was an expression of a peculiar, radical conservative philosophy. Radical in the sense that it focused on grassroots mobilization, organized dramatic confrontations with power structures, and eschewed formal deals or electoral endorsements. Conservative in its general avoidance of coalition building with progressive groups, its apotheosis of family values, in common with charismatism, and its selection of only winnable issues, one at a time, from an agenda that emphasized Catholic moralism, opposition to family planning counseling in high schools, for example, as much as community empowerment and economic survival. Moreover, as many frustrated organizers who have attempted to work with UNO or its sister organizations have complained, its self-image of grassroots democracy is sometimes belied by the behind-the-scenes machinations of IAF advisors and church leadership. Thanks primarily to the energy of Olivares and his parish members, UNO took off spectacularly in 1977-8, with a high-profile campaign against discriminatory auto insurance rates on the East Side, a neighborhood survival issue in a city with inadequate public transport. Mass demonstrations and aggressive political lobbying prompted a Federal Trade Commission investigation and a substantial reduction in local auto insurance rates. Buoyed by this success, UNO, claiming over 90,000 affiliated families by early 1980, launched new campaigns to win housing rehabilitation funds, build new supermarkets, and improve Eastside schools. In a typical mobilization right out of the Alinsky textbook, 1,300 UNO members packed a school board meeting in June 1980, protesting poor educational quality and incompetent administration in local schools. In a heated shouting match, UNO President Gloria Chavez commandeered control of the meeting, forcing board members to answer only yes or no to carefully prepared questions from the audience, while keeping a scoreboard tally of their responses. Confrontations like this one, whether or not they produce immediate results, were always powerful morale builders for both UNO and the church. According to an enthusiastic Bishop Arzurbe, the first cycle of UNO actions produced a tremendous unity of laypeople, priests, and sisters that we've never had before. This has brought many people back to active church participation because they felt that for the first time we were not telling them something that they had to do, but were asking them, what are your concerns? What are your needs? Although neither charismatism or UNO by themselves could mitigate the stagnation of the Manning years or make up for the bitter legacy of McIntyre, their local success emboldened Mahoney in his dramatic debut before his Eastside flock. The day after his installation, he launched the most ambitious polling of the Catholic grassroots ever attempted in the USA. For the first time, ordinary Latino as well as Anglo-Catholics were invited to participate in setting goals for the archdiocese. Over the course of a year, 70,000 people attended parish assemblies or regional convocations, while 320,000 answered questionnaires in Spanish as well as English on the archdiocese's mission. One result, ratified by an archdiocese-wide convocation in November 1986, was a new focus on providing counseling and social services to troubled youth and deprived families.